Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Media Voices, the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And I believe that we actually have a birthday to celebrate right now.
No.
So I think so. So, happy 50th birthday to the Sun newspaper. Many f***ing happy returns. But we also have to celebrate the birthday of another very influential woman in media. I think PT would agree with that. Our very own Esther.
Yay.
Esther, as our present to you, why don't you announce when the Publisher Podcast Awards entries are going to close?
The Publisher Podcast Award entries are closing this Friday, the 22nd of November. So you have literally a week to get your entries in.
Okay, Esther, who did you talk to this week?
So this week I spoke to Dori Carr-Harris, who is the executive editor at Vice. So she oversees all of their US verticals, including Broadly Munchies, Vice Sports and more. So we talked about their plans to launch an account for Munchies on TikTok, why astrology is so popular with Gen Z, whether she ever feels pressure to tone down the brand, and what her outlook is for digital pureplays.
Before that, though, we do want to remind you to take our listener survey. There is a link to it in our newsletter and on social. It will take you literally 5 minutes, and it will really help us grow the brand. Before that, as ever, the news roundup. And The Atlantic is revamping its app to be subscriber-only. So the app launched this week alongside a redesign for the brand, free to download, but users have to pay to read any of the articles or other app content. And Esther, I think you wrote this, so given that most of the users of the app are subscribers anyway, this makes sense to you.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what's in the water at the moment because, like, so many apps are launching. So, like, The Guardian's launched a subscriber-only app, The Eye's launched a paid app. There's been another couple recently.
The Information did the ticker.
Yeah. And it's just, it's almost this, it's swinging back around, even though the Digital News Report this year found that people don't really tend to use news apps that much.
Yeah.
It's this kind of acknowledgement that if you are one of these people using it, you are part of this kind of real inner circle of really loyal readers. So the previous version of the app, it had quite a low user number, but 3/4 of those subscribers actually visited it 3 or more times a week. So I think The Atlantic are kind of looking at this as a bit of a habit-forming platform rather than particularly going for for a conversion play.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. You know, it is for the most elite of the elite, the ones who you are, you know, expecting to have the most points of contact with. I also wonder if it's to do with the fact that if you look at across emerging markets where people are spending their time online, a lot of it is within apps. I almost wonder if this is future-proofing to some extent.
It's definitely future-proofing, but I don't think it's an emerging markets thing. So I'm just back from Las Vegas, which is why I sound like I'm more sleepier than normal on this freaking podcast. And I talked to Johnny Calder from PugPig about this. One of the things that he said was that Apple News Plus has actually spurred some people to do some stuff because they're looking at it and thinking, yeah, this can be a decent user experience.
Well, at least something good's come out of Apple News Plus.
And I think they're also thinking, well, we don't want to give all our money to Apple anyway. So people are coming round to the idea of doing it right again.
Yeah.
When the iPad first came out and people threw everything but the kitchen sink at their apps and they were amazing, but they were madly impractical and unprofitable.
Yeah.
And then everyone went full on PDF conversion and they were practical but not a particularly good user experience. Now people are going back and think, okay, technology's maybe caught up with where we want to be. And they're trying to do it right again.
I was actually at PugPig's customer day a few weeks back and they were talking quite a bit about this. And it's, I think there's this idea that when publishers launched apps, they expected to have the same kind of scale they had on desktop, and that was never going to be the case. So they hit low numbers and kind of gave up.
Maybe now, what with, you know, the kind of huge migration over to mobile,
you might
see sort of some of that scale moving across, but definitely not all.
But even then, it's kind of now there's that recognition of the value that if you get one person to download that app, that means a lot more than them just kind of flying by on your website, even on mobile.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, some of the stats they had about the length of time people were spending on these apps, it was like, I think there's an average of about 21 minutes a day across their apps.
Mm.
And I think there's another interesting thing that Matt Skibinski of the Lenfest Institute actually said in a DigiDay article on this. Publishers who basically want real quick wins when it comes to consumer revenue are putting loads of effort into desktop because kind of the actual conversion happens there, but the consumption happens on mobile. So he says there's a bit of a gap and that apps like this are definitely more of a retention play than kind of than conversion.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we said the other week about the Guardian's app.
I definitely see that. I think desktop is actually slipping further and further, not irrelevant, but it's becoming less important compared to things like apps, obviously, but also newsletters, which were just becoming less important because you don't have that personal relationship. It can be a drive-by on desktop.
Well, talking of newsletters, actually, that's quite interesting because Newman Lab drew some parallels between The Atlantic's new app and its newsletters.
Oh, yeah.
And they've apparently kind of tried to model the way that they deliver content on the app on their newsletters because their newsletters are so successful. So it's come back to this idea of editions. They actually update the app twice a day. Which, again, is something that when the Times did that on their app 10 years ago, everybody thought they were absolutely bonkers. You know, digital, you can be constant. And the Times actually said, well, no, people want to come to the app twice a day and know that they're getting like a start and a finish. And the Eye is, I'm pretty sure it's the Eye, has said that they're doing it in editions as well. A couple of these new apps that have launched have actually gone edition-based, which is really interesting. It's all swung back around.
So I was just going to say, reading that the Newman Lab article where they're talking about this being curated and written by humans. I love the way that something's been created by a human has actually become a feature of these apps. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I don't even know if it's a feature. I don't know if that's the right word. I think it's a sales pitch, you know, considering that people want to know that everything isn't just dictated by the algorithm and stuff.
And what's the features and benefits of your new app? Well, actually, it's curated and written by humans. Christ.
Moving on then, here's one that I actually really want to get your opinions on. Oof. So, I set this up ahead of time. OneIFRA's World Press Trends 2019 report demonstrates that there's been a 208% growth in digital news subscribers over the last 5 years, which... Yay!
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this does directly correlate to the number of publishers who've put up paywalls and focused on reader revenue. So, I mean, it's great, but it's not unexpected.
Also, 208% sounds amazing, but it's over 5 years.
Yeah.
And it could be Sweet Fanny Adams off a really low base.
Yeah, it is. We're not trying to downplay any successes here. So Tortoise Media gained nearly 20,000 members within the first 6 months of its launch.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fantastic.
What is amazing about that is the fact that almost half of those are under 30.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is really encouraging.
Yeah, it is encouraging. I don't know if it's necessarily unexpected. I think younger people are more... You know, they're more used to paying for things online. And
Chris,
if you
don't pay for stuff, we're ruining everything.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, we're certainly not buying diamonds, which is apparently bad somehow. I don't know. Before we get into Apple News Plus, I just wanted to check something with the two of you.
God, Apple News Plus a lot, haven't we?
Yeah.
What's going
on? So, just recently, earlier this month, the News Media Alliance and the University of Minnesota's Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication...
Easy for you to say.
...and the Star Tribune put out a study that basically said that some of that success... is actually or should be attributed to a positive correlation between spending more on entertainment subscriptions and spending more on news media subscriptions. So they're effectively saying that Netflix, Spotify, and their ilk are preparing people to pay for news. What's your gut reaction to that finding, to that sort of headline?
I get that if you pay for stuff, you're more likely to pay for other stuff. Mm-hmm. I get that. But the decision-making process, you know, to pay for Spotify or Netflix is very different from deciding to pay for, I don't know, whatever, the Atlantic app or a newspaper website. It's a different process.
Yeah. Esther, what's your take?
I would agree with it a little bit. I think it's part of quite a complex mix of factors. I mean, things like... we have seen the Trump bump, the Brexit bump, the desire for people to want to now find quality news, which I actually think is probably a bigger driver. Yes, it's great that we're warmed up to paying for subscriptions, but that's actually more likely to contribute to saying, actually, I can't afford any more this month because I'm already paying out like £70 in subscriptions.
Do you know the other thing that I find weird in this? So imagine the people that have Netflix, right?
Yep.
Which is everyone.
It's me, yeah.
And then imagine the people that have a subscription to the Atlantic's new app. That's not everyone. Netflix is kind of... It's almost like I've got Netflix the same way as I've got hot water.
Holy shit. That should be on Netflix's promotional material.
It should be. But you know what? You know what I'm saying, though? It's some things just become part of your life.
Yeah. You know, people typically tend to have 4 digital subscriptions on average. 2 entertainment... 1 sort of general news product and then 1 specialist news product. And I think it was in that order. or maybe it was the specialist news product and then a generalist news product. So it's not necessarily that, you know, people paying for news then gets them, Netflix gets them into a funnel where they then inevitably pay, because there's a quote in the piece that says, in terms of perceived value of different types of subscriptions, consumers are willing to pay more for sports content and streaming music subscriptions.
But I saw research at this FIP Congress. When people were asked, they said, oh yeah, we love our subscription, we got really, really good value for it.
Mm.
And then they were asked how much they were paying for it, and they're like, don't know. So the perception of value is more important than the actual price tag.
That is so interesting, because who was it? Who was it recently?
I can't remember who the
said. Can't remember which publication it was, but people told them you should be charging. Their consumers said you should be charging more. Was it The Economist? You should be charging more for your digital subscription.
So they put their price up and they got a big backlash a couple of months ago. But you know, that's something that always happens.
That's an interesting one as well, because Netflix, Spotify, they're all sort of around the same sort of like $10 a month price point. So are they then price anchoring general news subscriptions around the same? Obviously, like the ticker is priced way higher than that. But are other news products now sort of like stymied a little bit by the fact that they have to almost be around that price point?
Well, I mean, there is this joke that like everything that comes out is now $9.99 a month. Like Apple News Plus is $9.99 a month. But I mean, the Atlantic's app is about $4.99, I think.
Okay.
That subscription we were talking about last week was just $14 a year to that journalist. Probably there's a slight advantage if you do go down the micro line, that people think, oh, it's only the price of a cup of coffee a month rather than...
Yeah. Well, that's only the price of a cup of coffee a week.
That, yeah. But do you remember when the Guardian used that as their sort of like central tenet of their membership promotion, and it really came across as very hectoring, because it's like, oh, well, I want a cup of coffee.
I know, I don't want to give up my coffee.
Yeah.
Also, coffee is ridiculously overpriced.
Well, that's, I mean, do we have time?
Coffeenomics. I wonder if there's a newsletter called Coffeenomics.
Almost, I reckon probably Agribriefing have launched it.
Anyway, I think there's another important factor that we're overlooking here. I'm going to bring it back to the subject and away from coffee. And that is that publishers have got better at understanding what makes people tick, what makes people pay. You know, some of the stuff we've seen with metered paywalls, smart paywalls.
Yeah.
And they've, since being burned by the whole scale issue, they've gone back and said, what we need to get revenue from the readers, how can we do that? And I think that's likely to be a bigger contributor than readers being warmed up to subscriptions. It's more that publishers have got better at communicating the value they offer.
I also think people know now what to expect to some extent. You know, they've maybe done a few free trials and they think, okay, I can see myself paying for this in a way that 2 years ago they didn't really know what they would be paying for.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is moving on in that sense. Jesus, we almost sound optimistic for the future for publishing.
You should be getting back more often.
Too tired to be pissed off.
Too tired to be outraged.
So the news in brief, Facebook has launched Facebook Pay in the US a little bit out of the blue this week, probably due to Libra pretty much collapsing. That will let users pay other people and businesses across Messenger, WhatsApp and Instagram.
Talking about reality shaking itself apart, Instagram is rolling out its hiding likes test in a bid to improve mental health on the platform. Oh God, okay, so you're going to have to explain that to me. How does that make a difference?
Okay, so if I am a young woman and I'm looking at other young women and feeling like I'm not as popular... it doesn't matter anymore because I can't see how popular the other people are without literally going in and counting every single individual like. So I can post a picture, like just being a bit more chilled out, that they can't instantly see my place in the social hierarchy, and I can't instantly see how like not cool I am compared to them.
Yeah, it's removing that perverse incentive for people to compare themselves to other people based on things that actually don't really, that are completely arbitrary.
Okay, good. Well done, Instagram.
Well, it's also launched a TikTok clone in Brazil called Reels to fight back against the rapidly rising Chinese social rival.
I don't understand the world I live in anymore.
Okay, you might understand this one. FT editor Lionel Barber is stepping down early next year, with his deputy Roland Calaf succeeding him to become the first female editor in its 131-year history.
That's a good story.
It's a really good story, yeah. We spoke about this before, but probably best to put it in some context. Apple is struggling to attract new subscribers to its paid news app, Apple News Plus. So after signing on 200,000 subscribers with a free trial, that's key, in the first month, that number hasn't really grown, according to insiders. In fact, the article I read said that it's basically just been in neutral since.
Newspaper chain McClatchy is in financial difficulties and is exploring options to meet its 2020 obligations, including potentially a sale of the company. So more M&A.
So NewsQuest has gatecrashed the Daily Mirror owner's attempt to buy JPI Media. JPI owns titles including The Scotsman and The Yorkshire Post. And NewsQuest has effectively put in an offer to create this vast UK regional newspaper powerhouse.
Has anyone ever said in like the last 5 years, UK regional newspaper powerhouse?
Don't think so.
Condé Nast's Teen Vogue, which dropped its monthly print edition for a quarterly last year, is now cutting print entirely to become an online-only publication. That didn't last long.
Women's Health are launching their own weekly podcast on Boxing Day. Yes, Women's Health. It's called Going for Goal.
You're not totally a fan?
I'm not feeling the name. Going for goal. Shouldn't it be like going for the going for goals or going for goal? Oh, I get it. I'm going for goal.
You need to go to bed.
I get it now. And they're doing it after seeing success with a month-long trial podcast about body confidence. Go Women's Health.
And finally, The Mirror did a whole issue dedicated to the climate crisis, which is extremely welcome since realistically every issue of every newspaper should just be shots of flooding and wildfires, and all the articles and editor's notes should just be incoherent screaming.
That sounds like my life.
So this week I spoke to Vice's executive editor, Dori Carr-Harris. Vice has actually recently undergone some structural changes, so I began by asking her how her role now fits into all of this.
I'm an executive editor in our digital newsroom, and the way that our newsroom works in the US right now is since May, when we sort of moved all of our distinct verticals back into one major vice.com, we've sort of split the newsroom into a variety of different desks that cover a bunch of topics. And so my purview is to really oversee our culture and entertainment desks, lifestyle, style, and that really encompasses everything from movie, TV, film, food, to health and wellness, sex, personal finance, drugs, recreational drug coverage. So it's quite a wide purview. But my general role is to really sort of guide and shape the coverage in those areas and oversee sort of, quality and journalistic standards and really build, along with our executive leadership team, the sort of digital strategy in those areas.
And is that easier to do now that all the verticals are under that quite clearly branded umbrella, or has that become a bit more challenging?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the short answer is it's a lot easier. I think it's now that we're able to sort of be one coherent unit, in terms of developing the strategy, it's a lot easier to be able to build something forward-looking for one major entity than to have to, fine-tune and tailor a similar but slightly different strategy for a whole bunch of smaller properties. Also, I think, the way that we've really been thinking about it is in terms of the value that we can now provide to our audience. Being able to come to one destination and find everything that you're looking for versus having to go to a bunch of different URLs, different O&Os, I think is a much more beneficial and exciting experience for our audience. So that's been really, really a great boon to, I think, our coverage and our teams here. And also it's much more efficient to be able to sort of work as one organism rather than as a bunch of siloed sites.
And Vice has got, I think to put it politely, it's got quite a distinctive voice. It's got quite a clearly defined audience. But how is it evolving its tone and focus? It's basically the core audience of what used to be 20-something millennials are now basically growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually that the question is a little flawed in the sense that, yes, our core audience, who started out with us is evolving and aging, but we are also every day bringing in new users who are still 18 to 25. I think that what is exciting now about the coverage that we're doing is that we're able to really appeal to actually quite a broad swath of people. Yes, our audience that's been sort of diehard Vice readers are growing with us as we continue to build out coverage in the areas or around the issues that are pertinent to them, while we simultaneously continue to speak to the young audience that we sort of made our brand on. So I think that what we're thinking about is, what are the sort of specific issues or topics that are interesting to an 18 to 25 year old demographic versus what are the topics and, you know, stories or issues that are facing maybe that like 26 to 35 demographic, but also what are the sort of key issues, universal sort of instincts and stories and problems that face that wider demographic, and how can we sort of start to guide and build up and speak to that younger audience and then bring them with us through their evolution to where our core audience is now in that sort of older, I guess you could say, demographic. So I think it's less about like, how do we evolve our tone, and really about how do we continue to speak to young people in the world today in a way that feels relevant to them and feels important.
I'm going to say no advice for mortgages then. Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, we're really thinking about, especially in sort of our lifestyle coverage, how we can actually talk to, you know, an audience that is getting a little bit older, that is starting to tackle some of the sort of challenges that you might face in your early 30s, whether that's, you know, long-term or committed relationships, whether you're interested in marriage and how to navigate that, how to think about sort of changing family structures and what the family looks like. I think that what we're really trying to do with our coverage there is look at who the audience is and think about what problems they will be encountering and speak to those. So if that happens to one day be a discussion of mortgages, then so be it. But I think what we're really trying to do is help our audience navigate through life and whatever the sort of challenges are that are encompassed within that, then that's what we're going to talk about.
Completely left field question then relating to that. You're planning to launch an account for Munchies on TikTok this month. What's your experience of TikTok been like so far?
Well, I think TikTok is a very unique and interesting platform. We are launching our Munchies channel on, I believe, November 18th is the exciting day. But, you know, we've always been keen to take on and expand to new platforms. And I think, you know, we saw that and really leaned into that back in 2015 when we launched on Snapchat Discover. But Snapchat and Discover especially is not like TikTok. On TikTok, the content really has to be original, fresh, organic. It needs to really lean into the sort of cringiness and humanity of the TikTok platform. And I think that's something that we're really trying to embrace. So while on Discover, we had sort of played around with both original franchises, but also how to format the content that we created for our O&O verticals onto that platform. With TikTok, we are taking a completely different approach where it will be all original content just designed for that platform so that it can really feel authentic and like have the right vibe, have the right tone of voice, and feel good to the audience and really speak to the audience that is on that platform. I think that, you know, TikTok is certainly a platform that does not suffer fools or people who have a very inauthentic brand voice. They're actually a platform that really celebrates that kind of zaniness, that kind of weirdness. And so I think for our for our launch and for the coverage that we're going to be doing there, we really want to create stuff that feels designed just for that platform and that audience. So, you know, with food coverage, food is actually really huge on TikTok as a sort of vertical or subject matter. And so we want to start by really talking to the audience who's there about the things that matter to them in that sort of subject area. So we'll be looking at sort of like dorm life or DIY or testing weird food combos or doing food ASMR, like stuff that's really key to and core to what Vice has always done.
That's going to have dedicated resource because you can't presumably use that same video for like Instagram stories or things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, because TikTok is certainly an exciting new platform that I think, you know, most people in the digital industry are looking to and thinking about as the new Snapchat, like it is something that we want to devote time and resources to. But at the same time, you know, we're really building up our sort of innovation team and the teams here that do a lot of that more interactive content. So we are actually created sort of a working group that can help sort of test this different storytelling format that will include Vice staffers, that will include culinary experts, producers, visual artists, and sort of audience development specialists to see how we can really experiment on this platform and create a really sort of like a new kind of Vice content.
You've got an astrology section as well on Vice that's kind of, I've read, has been quite popular with the next generation down, Generation Z. The Astro Guide app is actually getting paying subscribers. So what's the story behind that? Why is astrology still a thing?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, that question is like half a question of our story and also half a very existential question, I think, about people looking for structures to help create meaning in their lives, which is very much what astrology is. And I think, you know, back when we launched our sort of gender and identity focused vertical broadly back in 2015, witchcraft and astrology was actually one of the main pillars that we focused on because we could see that this was something that was starting to sort of gain in popularity, become part of the zeitgeist, and that young people were really focusing around. Because I think it actually is a way, you know, and there's a sort of spectrum of people in, who are excited about astrology who take it, some very seriously, some less so. But I think what people are really looking for is a way to sort of create structure and meaning in their lives and also a way to make sense of what is happening in the world around them and to them in their sort of interpersonal relationships. And I think what we saw is that that content, that the way that we were tackling it was really resonating with our readers. They would come back time and again, like, every month we'd see a huge spike when we launched our monthly horoscopes. And so we really wanted to think about how we could take that loyal audience that we had built and that community that we were involved with, that we were speaking to, and create sort of a premium product for them that would have value and that would have meaning. And I think, you know, recently, maybe a couple of months ago, we were written up in an article in the New Yorker that was looking at sort of astrology and its impact on society as being sort of the most informative and well-researched astrology app, because obviously there are a few out there. And I think that really speaks to what our strategy has been all along, which is that we're taking it really seriously. And I think there are a lot of people out there who, you know, like think that astrology is kind of, you know, it's shoddy or it's like woo-woo or whatever it is. And like they are more than welcome to their opinions. But I think what we decided to do that I think is a little different from how some other publications might have been treating astrology is that we decided to go really deep and immerse ourselves within that community as is our tendency, as is sort of the Vice way. Take it really seriously, and that comes out in our coverage, so that not only was it important for us to be able to provide value to an audience who was dabbling in this, you know, whether it was like just weekly horoscopes or just wanting to know what their compatibility is, who are sort of just scratching the surface, but we also wanted to be taken seriously by the astrology community, and we are. And so I think that that is really where we've been able to provide value to the readers and why people have ended up paying for this app, is that we went really deep. We were like, well, if this is what you guys want and what you're interested in, then we're going to take this incredibly seriously and give you a really sort of nuanced, inclusive, diverse astrology app and format.
And as an editor, do you ever feel pressure to tone down kind of Vice's viceness, to appeal to sponsors and partners who seem to be increasingly sort of wanting a safer environment these days?
No, not at all. I mean, I think on the first level, like, we have a really well-delineated sort of church and state separation at Vice. But beyond that, like, I think that it's, in fact, our sort of fresh and direct approach, which is why brands come to us. You know, they're looking for that sort of brand trust, reputation, authenticity of voice. And I think they're looking for an audience that demands that, that's loyal to that, and that is excited by that. And I think, you know, to that extent, like, at our New Friends presentation earlier this year, our sort of president of international and global chief revenue officer, Don Delport, talked about our decision to sort of take these sort of 25 significant words that were on this sort of brand blacklist off, and why we sort of stood behind content that included those words. And those are words such as bisexual, gay, LGBTQ, HIV, Jewish, Muslim. I think our POV is, we understand, but we're actually like, those topics are so core to our coverage and to our audience, especially for younger generations like Gen Z and millennials, that we feel very passionately about covering those topics, and we are not going to shy away from those things, because that, like, these are so much so part of the lived experience of those generations and what they care about, that we couldn't really be who we are and shy away from those topics. And so I think that that really sums it up, in that, like, in order to be able to build the audience that we want to capture and continue to be relevant to it, we need to push forward with our sort of bold, direct approach. And brands that want to work with us and who come to work with us are really looking to be able to tap into that audience. And I think that they know that in order to do that, they have to be ready to sort of, you know, grapple with some of this subject matter, or at least understand that it's a part of the lives of the audience that they're trying to reach.
And I mean, presumably that audience will pull you up quite quickly if you weren't covering those things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to imagine a world in which we didn't. And I think, you know, as we've always said, like, our audience has a really strong bullshit detector. And so the second that we started to sort of back away from that, like, they would sense it in an instant. And I just don't really think that's a proposition that we're that interested in.
And you've been at Vice since 2015. Yeah. And that time has been, to put it mildly, pretty tough for a lot of digital pure plays. What are some of the biggest challenges you've seen, either good or bad, in the way that Vice has adapted to the digital media landscape? I mean, you're still here, so that's a good thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, yes, the last, you know, 5 years, 4 or 5 years have been incredibly challenging for the industry as a whole. I think there have been a ton of sort of roller coasters, whether that's sort of been like the Facebook algorithm roller coaster, or ad sales, or pivot to video. They've sort of all come and gone through the industry. And I think that what the sort of biggest positive change, I think, has been in terms of where we are now, is that there's really sort of a focus on wanting to just, like, tell great stories and have fun doing that. I think Vice has been lucky in that we've been able to get ahead of some of those roller coasters or that uncertainty by diversifying our business, diversifying in terms of platforms and also in terms of sort of the types of business that we're participating in. And so I think that for this question specifically, like, we aren't just a digital pure play, right? Like, we have a television network, we have an advertising agency, we have, you know, deals with Showtime now and Hulu, where having that diversified revenue has actually really offered us a little bit more freedom to experiment in the digital world or to sort of, you know, ride the waves as they come. But what I think has really sort of carried through is that we really just want to focus on our storytelling, on building our audience, and on providing like really empathetic, cutting edge, like deeply investigative coverage on our platform that can help to inspire our audience and help them navigate through a world that honestly becomes increasingly complicated each day.
And apart from TikTok, what sort of things are you guys focusing on next year?
I think we really want to continue to focus on publishing great stories across platforms that have impact. We want to grow our audience, obviously, and we want to make sure we're continuing to diversify it and build it out, or looking to really build out our global audience. I think that's something that we're really going to be focusing on in 2020 is how we can continue to have a global impact, really build out, you know, we have offices all around the world, so continuing to build out infrastructure there to make sure that we're really working together to provide a real global snapshot of the world to our audience on any given day. I think that one thing that's really helped us as a media company over the last few years of change is that this company was really built on change as the norm. It's certainly like we've always privileged experimentation, tried to be on new platforms, tried, you know, different types of businesses. And I think what that's actually done and what that's created is an environment where change is the status quo. So as the industry shifts around us and as some of the, you know, I think our competitors sort of grapple with these sea changes and with a shifting landscape, I think because change has been our bread and butter, we are not as shocked as some of our competitors, or we have the ability to just sort of keep pushing forward because we're used to always sort of being in a state of flux. And I think for me personally, that's why it's always been exciting to come to work here, is that there's constantly a desire for creativity, for new ideas, and to sort of push the envelope further. I think that that is why, you know, in an industry where people sort of hop around from publication to publication and change jobs every couple of years, I have felt excited to stay at Vice because there's always been sort of new opportunities, whether it's a new platform that we're experimenting on or a new type of coverage or a new topic that we really want to build out into. There's always been new opportunities to learn, to shape new coverage, to try something new.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you saw or read or watched that really affected you?
Yeah, well, I have two, actually. So the first one is I've been ravenously consuming the new podcast, Dolly Parton's America. It's put out by the sort of team who produces Radiolab, and it's a look at sort of Dolly Parton, the sort of icon, but also it takes a look at sort of how her music is emblematic of sort of changing and shifting America. And she is obviously an incredible human being, who certainly has a mythic status, but it really does ring true. So that's been something that has been, especially as we're sort of gearing up in the U.S. for our 2020 election, something that's been really grounding and a really interesting way to sort of interact with and investigate our sort of changing America and the narratives within it from a different perspective and a different way into that conversation. And then the other thing is, shamelessly a plug, we just published our 100 best albums of the decade list on Vice, and it was truly a labor of love, but honestly when I was reading it, just was so inspiring and nostalgic and exciting to look at all the amazing albums that have come out over the last decade, to really think about all the different musical trends that have been collapsed into the last 10 years, and just to revisit some favorites that I hadn't really thought about in a few years.
So as ever, we do remind you every week, we have a newsletter. It goes out every Wednesday and it includes a link to the latest episode and a curated list of everything we've been reading on the web.
By humans.
By humans. This week, it also features a link to our listener survey. So please do check that out and give us some feedback.
And if you want regular news updates, have a look at Twitter, where we are at Media Voices Pod, or have a look at the website. All our past episodes are on there, 122, I believe.
Oh my God.
Count. But there's a bunch of other stuff on there. Go and have a look. Go on. Do yourself a favour. Have a look. And the address of our website where you can find all that good stuff is voices.media.
And we mentioned it at the beginning, but just to reiterate that the Publisher Podcast Awards are closing this week. Make sure you've got your entry in by going to publisherpodcastawards.com, or if you just want to follow us on Twitter, you can find us on PubPod Awards.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another absolutely incredible guest and a wry look at everything that's going on in the news and media world, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.